From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Nazi Holocaust survivors file suit against German companies that used slave labor. Today on Democracy Now!, Elly Gross was just one of thousands of people forced to work for no money at Volkswagen during the Nazi regime. Mrs. Gross will be our guest here in the studio, plus the 12th annual summit of the Non-Aligned Movement. We'll have a report from South Africa and a feminist look at the global economy. All that and more here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Well, good morning. I am Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman, and you are listening to Democracy Now! From Pacifica Radio. First, these headlines: a Swiss airplane with 229 passengers and crew crashed into the Atlantic Ocean off Canada's coast, and at least 18 bodies, but no survivors, have been found so far Thursday. The Swiss airplane, Flight 111, en route from New York to Geneva, crashed off Nova Scotia at 9:30 p.m. Wednesday as it prepared to make an emergency landing. Both Swissair and the aircraft type had exceptional safety records before the crash. The crew reported smoke in the cockpit, and the wide-bodied plane crashed as it tried to make an emergency landing at Halifax Airport about 1 hour 40 minutes after takeoff from New York. Swissair officials said a total of 215 passengers, including two infants and 14 crew, were aboard the flight. A Delta Airlines spokesman said 53 Delta passengers and one Delta flight attendant were also on the Swissair plane because it was a code-sharing flight that could carry Delta ticket holders. The chief executives of Swissair's parent company said he didn't believe any of the passengers and crew survived. South African President Nelson Mandela did a U-turn on the war in the Democratic Republic of Congo Thursday as President Laurent Kabila's allies offered peace but prepared to take the fight to the rebels. Mandela's change of heart to favor foreign military intervention in the month-old civil war followed a meeting of the 14-nation South African Development Community, or SADC, also attended by the United Nations Secretary General Kofi Annan. When the legitimate head of a government of a country says, "I've been invaded by a foreign force, come and help me defend my country," it's quite reasonable for the neighboring country to respond positively, Mandela told reporters. Kabila, who arrived unexpectedly in the South African city of Durban on Wednesday to join his military allies Angola, Zimbabwe, and Namibia at the summit of the 113-nation non-aligned movement, did not attend the SADC meeting. Britain's supplementary new anti-terror package won parliamentary support after debate lasting until dawn this morning. The lower House of Commons swept aside some members' protests that the government was just trying to bounce them into passing draconian anti-terror measures too quickly. Shortly after the vote, President Clinton arrived in Northern Ireland to show his support for the province's peace process. The president, on a one-day trip, was due later to make a speech to politicians and community leaders and visit Omagh. The bill, approved overnight, will be debated by the unelected Upper House of Lords later on Thursday before becoming law. Prime Minister Tony Blair called Parliament back from its summer break Wednesday to consider the legislation framed after last month's Omagh bombing, in which 228 people died. It makes it easier to convict people of belonging to outlawed Northern Irish groups, giving courts the right to rely on evidence given by a single senior police officer and to regard an accused person's refusal to answer police questions as an indication of guilt. Defense lawyers for former Rwandan Prime Minister John Kambanda, who has pleaded guilty to genocide before a UN tribunal, have urged the court to treat him leniently when passing sentence Friday. Defense counsel Michael Inglis told the court on Thursday that Kambanda, premier during Rwanda's 1994 genocide, was little more than a puppet with diminished responsibility who acted under duress. Both Inglis and prosecution lawyers said Kambanda's admittance of guilt May 1st this year should be taken in mitigation for the crimes of genocide, complicity in genocide, and crimes against humanity of which he has been convicted. But Inglis said a 2-year jail sentence would be sufficient punishment before Kambanda started working for the reconciliation process in Rwanda. Riot police stormed plants of South Korea's largest auto parts maker Thursday to break up an 18-day-old strike by thousands of workers protesting layoffs in coordinated dawn assaults at seven Mando Machinery Corporation plants around the country. Some 8,000 riot police used bulldozers and tear gas to break through barricades and disperse strikers. Police quickly overpowered workers in five smaller plants, but fierce fighting erupted at the company's two main plants in central South Korea, where about 800 workers were holed up. Japan's military went on increased alert Thursday to prepare for a possible second ballistic missile test launched by North Korea. Japanese media also quoted ITS Chief Cabinet Secretary as saying the government had information the launch could be held as early as Saturday. Kyoto said military ships were being dispatched to the Sea of Japan to monitor any possible missile launch. You're listening to Democracy Now!, usually here with Amy Goodman. She's on assignment still in Nigeria. She'll be back next week. I'm Laura Flanders, here with Juan Gonzalez, columnist at the New York Daily News. Good morning, Juan.
Good day, Laura. And I see the situation in with the markets continues to bubble. And the New York Times reports today that hedge funds, these almost largely unknown financial and investment firms that concentrate on moving the money of millionaires. They don't advertise. They're not regulated. You can only join a hedge fund by word of mouth. But they move billions of dollars every day. Of course, George Soros is the most famous hedge fund person in the world, head of Quantum Fund. And it's the hedge funds that lost huge amounts of money. And some people suspect that when they were losing money in Russia and Hong Kong in recent weeks is when they started dumping money in the stock, dumping stocks here on Wall Street to help make up for their losses and create the huge drop that occurred on Monday. And it's important to understand that these hedge funds exacerbate all the ups and downs of markets all around the world. And right now in Hong Kong, in Taiwan, in Malaysia, governments are beginning to unite to control these international speculators and to put restrictions on their ability to bring whole governments and whole countries down.
Well, we're going to be talking more about the turbulence in the global market and what it has to do with unpaid women's work and the unpaid work of others later in the program. But first, let's go to South Africa, where this week 113 nations are meeting for the 12th annual summit of the Non-Aligned Movement. Participating members came together initially during the Cold War, when the world was dominated by the U.S. and the Soviet Union. But today, many of these same non-aligned countries have still been left out of so-called global economic developments, which are still dominated by Western powers and other countries in the Far East. South African President Nelson Mandela assumed the chairmanship of the Non-Aligned Movement this week and announced that he was going to redefine its mission in the next 3 years under his leadership. He urged a new relationship between the world's rich and poor nations. And for more, we're going to go to an analyst on international affairs who has been covering the Non-Aligned Movement Summit in Durban, South Africa, for the South African Broadcasting Corporation. His name is Johnny Moloto. Johnny, We talked about what the discussions, I've touched on what the discussion was in Durban. Tell us a little bit what the agenda has been and how it's been discussed so far.
Well, what they've done in terms of the agenda was to split the issues into economic and social issues as well as political issues. So there were two committees discussing these issues. And the sessions were closed. Basically, to us, we had just radio feeds from that. But thus far, the outcomes from those sessions will be made final, obviously, when the report of the conference comes out. But as the situation stands now, what South Africa has done as chairman of the current non-aligned movement was to put to the table in the Economic and Social Council 27 proposals. And out of those 27, they've got something, I think 22, if not 26, out of those passed. And the one that's really thorn in the flesh is on the inclusion of a social clause in the World Trade Organization, which is for protection of child labor and so and other issues related to that. And furthermore, on the political side of things, South Africa has proposed, made seven proposals, and out of that they got six in. And the seventh one, which was problematic, was the one of including small arms as well in the, on the agenda of disarmament, that is small arms and land mines as part of the disarmament process. Other states refused to support those proposals. And what's happened, India as well has vehemently stated that she wants to be regarded as a nuclear power. She wants that to go on record, to be recorded at these NAM proceedings, that she is a nuclear power and she should be recognized as such. So that's what the agenda has been thus far.
Johnny Maloto, has there been any discussion of the increasing turbulence in the world economic system and its impact on the non-aligned countries? I know, for instance, in Indonesia now, there's 20% unemployed, and many countries in Southeast Asia are in, and in, of course, obviously, Russia is also, but Southeast Asia are virtually prostrate economically. Has there been any discussion of what's going, of any changes or policies in that direction?
There have been discussions, yes. But, you know, with these meetings, it's very hard to tell as to which direction they'll go. But as I said yesterday, South Africa did set the tone to say that, you know, under our chairmanship, we prepare. The only thing we're concerned with is not only the talks that we have here, but the outcomes and the implementation of those outcomes. And what has been said was the process of South Africa has been mandated to take the process of approving the report of the panel of economic experts of NAM, which was set up in New Delhi last year in India. And that panel submitted its report, and after those reports, that report was read to the meeting, South Africa was tasked with the implementation of that report. And one of the major tasks that came out of that was for South Africa and other members that are still going to be decided upon to go and consult with the developed states as to how they can be included in the process of negotiations on economic matters. And basically, they want to include the issue of debt relief as a priority, and market liberalization and globalization as a general aspect.
Tell us a little bit about who is there. The 113 nations make NAM, I think, the second largest international gathering of nations. Is that right?
Yeah.
It's the second after the United Nations, I believe.
Sorry?
Tell us some of the people that are there and the kind of sense that you get of what they perceive as their role in this new so-called post-Cold War era.
Oh, okay. Well, the most important person who was there, who came as an observer, was invited as an observer, was Secretary General of the United Nations, Kofi Annan, and his presence here, I think, was very important, as well as the point he made when he delivered his address yesterday. He said that he, as representative of Africa in the United Nations, was committed to the process of reforming the United Nations, and he was very happy that the United Nations, his proposals for reform of the United Nations were accepted by member states. And I think his presence, you know, just his presence here was very significant in more ways than one. It also helped to bring that sense that, you know, we must not lose sight of the fact of the issues that we are here for, despite of the little problems that SADC member states have had during the start of the, in fact, even before the start of the conference. That also brought in a new element of saying, you know, we have here two platforms that we can use at the same time to resolve those kind of problems, you know. He opened the door to saying that, you know, disputes like this or problems like this can also be discussed in other fora. So I think by his presence, he just basically increased the number of multilateral institutions that were already present at this summit. I mean, you had NAM, you had SADC, as well as you had the United Nations, mm-hmm, as well being present there.
And on that second,
us know what kind of power the Secretary General wields.
And on that second question of what the role of NAM is in 1998, can you give us some sense of what the participants understand to be the role of the organization?
The role of the organization now. I mean, from inception, NAM has been all about providing a unified voice for the third world states, states that felt that individually they could not achieve anything. As I said now, South Africa under its chairmanship has tried to come up with a drastic move from what NAM has been doing thus far, not only to have a talk shop and after that, you know, not follow up on resolutions that have been taken. The new NAM now, you know, the NAM of 98 is NAM that is committed, you know, to also lifting itself by its bootstraps and, you know, not only depending on charity of the West, but engage them in dialogue instead of adopting the previously hostile stage, you know, of engaging them in a hostile environment of saying, you know, they are seen to be the enemy. Now what they see them as are partners in a process of achieving their development.
Thank you so much. Johnny Mulotto is a radio analyst working right now covering the Durban summit of the Non-Aligned Movement for the South African Broadcasting Corporation. Thank you very much for being with us here on Democracy Now! While the talk was going on in Durban about the topics that Johnny Mulotto just laid out, in Nigeria there was still very vibrant response to the comments of General Abubakar, who was in attendance at the NAM summit, but it was the second time he'd been in South Africa in a week. And in Nigeria there was still ramifications to the comments that he'd made there a week before. For more, we're going to Jeremy Scahill, producer of Democracy Now! He's on assignment in Nigeria. Here's Jeremy.
Just as General Abubakar's plane touched down in Durban, South Africa, for the meeting of the Non-Aligned Movement, Nigeria's leading human rights lawyer, Chief Gani Fawahemi, blasted the Nigerian dictator for comments he made on his three-day visit to South Africa last week, when Abubakar told the South African parliament there are no political prisoners still in detention in Nigeria. Chief Fawahemi called this claim totally untrue and outlined the cases of just some of the political prisoners who continue to rot in General Abubakar's gulags, many without charge or trial. He pointed to the continued imprisonment of Moshood Fayamiwo, publisher of Nigeria's Razor magazine. Here in Nigeria, human rights activists and journalists refer to the Razor publisher as the Tunnel Man. He is being held in the dreaded Directorate of Military Intelligence, or the DMI, a facility known for widespread torture and abuse of activists and journalists. According to human rights activists, the publisher has not seen daylight since February of 1997, when he was abducted by Nigerian security operatives in the neighboring Republic of Benin. A human rights lawyer who was recently released from the DMI says Fayamiwo is being kept in an underground tunnel where he is chained permanently to an iron bar in a sitting position. The lawyer said each time the publisher needs attention, he hits his chains against the bar. Fayamiwo's family believes he is losing his sanity, and they say his only crime is his criticism of the military dictatorship. Also yet to be released are the Ogoni 20, who were arrested around the same time that leading Ogoni activist and playwright Ken Sarawiwa and eight others were hanged by the junta in November 1995. The Ogoni 20 remain under threat of being hanged and continue to be held in horrid prison conditions. They also are held without trial. Chief Fawahemi also highlighted the case of Bayo Oshinawo, who was a close aide of Moshood Abiola, the man many believe won the 1993 presidential election, and who died in prison under General Abubakar. Abiola's aide was arrested in September of 1997 and was disappeared in Nigeria's prison system. The Nigerian government has consistently denied knowledge of his whereabouts, but in April, Oshinawo was able to smuggle a letter out of the prison that revealed that he is in fact being held at a military barracks in the Nigerian capital, Abuja. And the list of political detainees who remain in prison under the regime of Abubakar goes on, despite the widespread praise the new dictator enjoys from the United States and other Western governments. Activists here call General Abubakar old wine in a new bottle and point out that he has yet to lift his omnipotent decrees, such as Decree 2, which allows the regime to detain people indefinitely without charge or trial. Chief Fawahemi has been the most vocal opponent of Abubakar's transition program and says that the continued detention of scores of human rights activists under Abubakar confirms that the new Nigerian regime is merely the twin monster of the dictatorship of the late dictator Sani Abacha. He called on the international community and members of the Non-Aligned Movement to demand that Abubakar explain to the world why a man who says he supports democracy keeps so many activists, journalists, lawyers, and scholars imprisoned in the gulags of Nigeria. Jeremy Scahill, Democracy Now!, Lagos, Nigeria.
That was Jeremy Scahill. I'm Laura Flanders here with Juan Gonzalez. You are listening to Democracy Now! Jeremy and Amy Goodman will be back with us next week. We're going to take a break now for 60 seconds. Stay tuned. Lucky to have with us in the studio a sociologist, economist, somebody who has been working with many people that we're familiar with here on Democracy Now!, but someone who rarely is in New York. Her name is Maria Meiss. She's a retired professor of sociology from University of Cologne in Germany and the co-author, perhaps most well-known to Democracy Now! Listeners, of Ecofeminism, the book co-authored by Vandana Shiva and Maria Meiss. She's also the author of Patriarchy and Accumulation on a World Scale and Women, the Last Colony. I hope we can touch on some of the main themes brought up in those books. It must have been interesting for you to be staying in a hotel just steps away from Wall Street. Did you manage to get any sense of what was happening on the stock exchange?
Yes. We went to the stock exchange just as tourists to see how it all works. And then we didn't realize very much of hectic at that moment, but we asked someone who was helping there, and he said, yes, everything is down, down. And it was only between 60 and 70 points down at that time, around 11 o'clock. And then when we came back from our sightseeing tour in the evening, it was already 500 points down. And the terms which were used was Black Monday and crashing of the big crash. And everybody was sort of reminding of something which we knew, of course, from the early 30s, 1929. Now, everybody here in the United States and in Europe as well has talked so far that the Asian crisis would never hit Europe. And I just came back to visit my sister here in the United States in Connecticut. She also felt, no, we are safe here. And she's a small stock owner also, one of those 50% of the American population who own small stocks. So this kind of unreality on the one hand of this optimism which is spread around by the media all over and the reality of a sudden crash or whatever it is, whether it's a crash one doesn't know, didn't come to me at least as a surprise, because we have been studying the world market for a long time, at least my friends and myself in Germany, from the perspective of women, particularly of women from the South. And if you look on the conditions under which women produce for this world market, I did this as early as 1979, 78 in India with a home-based industry of lace makers, women making lace for the world market, and they got at that time 50 paisa, that means half a rupee for a day, whereas the minimum wage for agricultural labor or women was 5 rupees or 3 rupees at that time. So you could see an enormous exploitation that's going on all over the world, and that is this famous global market. But what struck me most was that it seems, and that is what I learned since last year particularly, that the third world is coming back to the first. And such a crash or such a slumber, whatever they call it, was to be expected. I wasn't surprised. I was only waiting for the moment when it would happen. But it was just a coincidence that we were in the stock exchange when it happened.
No one's blaming you. It's okay. You talk, as many people do, of the reference point back to the 30s, and many in their analysis of what is happening in the markets these days try to look back to the 30s and say what's different, what's the same. One of the things that is missed when people do that is what we've come to know since the 30s about the economy, and particularly what we've come to understand about the function of race and gender. Now, your book, Patriarchy and Accumulation on a World Scale, was really a seminal, or what would be the feminist term for a seminal, text in that way. What does your analysis of gender politics add, you think, to the traditional analysis of how global markets work?
First of all, gender is an opportunity to lower, from an economic point of view, to lower wages, to lower labor costs. And that has been used throughout. And all the efforts to bring women's wages up to men's wages have failed, even in our countries. For instance, in Germany, the female wage is only 70% of the male wage. So after all these years of struggle and women's movement, etc., we were not able to do it. Now, the explanation cannot simply be that the men are so bad, that it's just sadism or whatever. But there is some economic logic behind this wage difference, even if you look only at our countries. And that is that capital can never pay the full costs of labor if it wants to continue accumulation. So it has to define people out of this economy. And we coined the term housewifeization for that externalization of women's labor out of the so-called economy. And in the later book, the last book I've written with another German friend, we talked about the iceberg economy, whereas the economy is seen only as capital and wage labor, which is the tip of the iceberg. And under the water, you have a whole series of layers of different types of labor. And housewife's labor, which is not paid at all, and that was our early analysis in the early 80s of what is housework under capitalism, mm-hmm. where we discovered this.
Although Frederick Engels surely had written about that.
Exactly. Many feminists at that time had, Silvia Federici and Maria Rosa della Costa in Italy were the first really to talk about this, that it is necessary to exclude that labor from the accounts of the capital. Okay, all this unpaid, half-paid, semi-paid, unprotected labor, not protected by labor laws, not protected by wage, by units, etc., is not just an accident that these types of labor are not being paid, but it's necessary for the ongoing of capital accumulation. But what is different from the 30s, and what is also different, I think, from what many people thought up till now, is that so far everybody thought if we have a little bit more unionization, if a bit more regulation, a bit more state interference, then we women, at least in the rich countries, will come up to the level of a male worker. Now, globalization has done just the opposite. Mm. And globalization has brought the third world labor relations and female labor relations, actually, has shown that this is the optimal labor, and not only for the third world, but also for us. And liberalization, deregulation, globalization are the three pillars of liberalism. And I would say housewife's labor means unpaid, unprotected, isolated, atomized, non-unionized, etc., is actually the model of the labor to come. And since we had this analysis already 20 years ago, we were not at all surprised by the tactics and strategy of capital do the same. Now, what people still believe that something like that could never happen to us here. But since I got involved in that movement against the MAI,
the Multilateral Agreement on Investments,
which nobody knew about in Germany. Not even the parliamentarians knew about it. The party people didn't know about it till we brought it to their notice. Shows very clearly that the freedom given to investors, to foreign investors, would eventually mean to break down all the protective laws for labor, which are still there, and to have similar types of labor, which we find in the third world, or which women have as housewifized labor, we call it, or home-based industries, or even these women working in the free trade zones in Asia, in Mexico, as you know, the maquiladoras. We even coined the term maquiladoras because this is the type of labor they would like to have in Germany, for instance.
Under the MAI.
Under the MAI. There are already so-called special economic zones in Germany, and they have the same kind of structure as free trade zones in Asia or in Mexico. In Poland, there are 19 such so-called special economic zones, and the finance minister of Poland has said we will not have any more of them because it puts such a pressure on all the other labor that they have to also go down with their wages that nobody can manage anymore. There one can see this is indeed the strategy of the MAI as far as economics is concerned.
It just makes me so crazy listening to you, not that I disagree, but that it becomes so clear how much of the story is left out and how crucial a part of the story is left out when economics is told just through the eyes of men, whether it's stockbrokers or heavy industrial workers. The pages of the business sections and the economics reporters that reporting that we see and read so often leaves women out of the picture altogether, and yet you're suggesting it is only by looking at the experience of women that we see really what is happening in the economy at large. Is that overstating things?
No, it's not overstating the things. It's also correct as far as the empirical evidence is concerned, but it doesn't give enough of an explanation, I would say. It's not just enough to be a woman and to have more women in that whole structure. You see, and they will do give, in fact, to some women the possibility to move up to the top of that iceberg economy, but at the expense of other women who will not. So that is definite. And also race plays an important role here, and class still plays an important role. But if we only look at women as, well, biological beings,
biological group,
that would not be an explanation. That's why we do not call this kind of labor, it's not just feminized, but it is housewifeized labor, because the definition of women as housewives, that means dependent on a breadwinner, is a kind of, is a kind of trick, or is a kind of construction. Today one would say the woman being constructed as a housewife was a trick to make this labor invisible. This
but anybody
unpaid
could
labor.
Be a housewife.
And now, that's what we said already in 1983, also men will be housewifeized. And that is what is happening now. They will have to accept, more and more men will have to accept this type of labor, falling under the waterline, you know, no longer. And the number of men and women on the top of that, and the tip of that iceberg, will be less and less. If you include now all the automation, all the new technology which is being used to make labor redundant, so you can imagine, people talk of a 20 to 80 society already. So, and that is actually what how capital tries to solve its crisis. But anyway, maybe you were.
No, I was just fascinated by what you're saying. I'm wondering, you've been clearly right so many times here, what do you see as what the future holds in this respect?
Yeah, since this is a series on democracy, I feel, I mean, the basic threat to democracy, which is a political theme, which the MAI brought to the forefront, that people are not informed about these contracts and these agreements which their governments make, the parliaments are not even involved in it, really has shocked so many people in our country. So I feel a kind of basic movement towards what I would call it, other friends like Vandana would call direct democracy.
Vandana Shiva.
Yeah, Vandana Shiva. We have to really take things into our own hands again. And not just the politics, but economics. And I saw, a sign of hope in that movement itself, which started in Canada, where whole cities declared themselves as MAI free.
MAI free.
MAI free. Or whole provinces. Now, the same thing has happened in Austria, of all countries, not in Germany. At least three of their provinces have already said they don't want to have anything to do with the MAI. That means, now, if one, this is a political decision, if these parliaments, these provincial parliaments say, we don't want to have anything to do with the MAI and we demand our federal government not to sign it, if more cities, more provincial governments, etc., people would say, no, nothing doing with that type of agreement. Now, that would necessarily, in my view, ask the question, now, what kind of economy do you want? If they really mean it seriously, like, for instance, in British Columbia, in Canada not to have anything to do with the MAI, then they will have to question the policy of the economic policy of the multinationals, and to make sure how they can control those multinationals.
Now
that would mean a kind of localized, regionalized economy where people again take control over their resources, over their economy, and over their politics. This is a kind of vision which we call a subsistence perspective, that people would try to live within the areas where they are, use the resources, which that does not mean that they are isolated at all, but they would refuse to be under the control of the big multinationals.
Now, that's on the national, countrywide basis. What about, to continue this metaphor of the housewife, on the domestic level? Different responses have come up in the last decades in response to the unpaid nature of housework. Some have called for housework to be paid.
Yes.
Some have called for housework to be included, given a value, a dollar value or a currency value in the gross domestic product of a nation. Following along that line of reasoning, how do you see a response, an appropriate response, to what you're referring to as the housewifification, perhaps, of larger and larger sectors of the economy?
I would say this might be possible for some countries, for some sections of that economy. For some women, it might be possible. But if you include all labor done in this world, and it is the bulk of it is female, unpaid, badly paid female labor, if all that labor would have to be included, not only in the national product, but being paid, properly paid, as I always use the example of a skilled German male worker, then this economy would collapse. And that is why even they may do it for some, but then they find other categories of women, mainly women, and some men also, where it would not take place. So I think it is not a strategy which really covers the whole global economy. And with that, I think we cannot now think of an economy unless we think of the global economy. Mm-hmm. We have to include what is happening in the third world in our analysis. And one of the mistakes which is being constantly made, that people do not talk about the economy. In the United States, although it is very heavily involved in the global economy, when I met people, their outlook is absolutely provincial. And that is more or less the same in Germany also. So it's an ignorance about what is really going on. And then you get these soap operas about Clinton and his love affairs, etc., to keep the people busy. So it's a totally unreal situation.
Until suddenly it comes home to roost.
Yes.
Thank you very much. Maria Mace's retired professor of sociology from Cologne University in Germany and the author of Patriarchy and Accumulation on a World Scale, also the co-author with Vandana Shiva of Ecofeminism. Thank you so much for being with us here on Democracy Now!
Thank you.
You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Laura Flanders. That was an interview recorded just a little bit earlier this week. Juan Gonzalez is with me here in the studio. Juan, I wish you could have been there when Maria was here with us in the studio. I meant what I said, that it was a treat to have her. Such clear thinking about the economy. One realizes how much one misses an economic analysis that starts by looking at what happens at the bottom and then sees the ramifications internationally rather than sort of cutting the bottom part out of the picture.
Yes, and it was amazing to see that the same kind of process that has occurred throughout the third world, this growth of these maquila zones, which are largely, as they are in Mexico, Dominican Republic, Honduras, and Taiwan and other places, overwhelmingly women workers, is also happening in Poland and now in Germany and other places. So, yes, it was an illuminating view of what's happening worldwide.
And it's so clear and so strong to make the point that it's not just women that this can happen to, but because of the sexist way that so much reporting is done and so much analysis is done, we as a population at large fail to see how important it is to look at what happens to women, because it can happen to everyone.
Yes.
Well, our next guest is, we were just talking about capitalism's reliance on unpaid labor, and our next guest is someone who knows that kind of labor all too firsthand. She was 15 years old when she entered Auschwitz. a Nazi concentration camp. But Ellie Gross didn't suffer the same fate as her mother and five-year-old brother, who were sent to the gas chambers there. Instead, she was forced to work as a slave for German automaker Volkswagen. She worked 12-hour days for no pay, and those who made mistakes risked being beaten by the guards. This week, she was part of a class action suit filed against Volkswagen. The suit is demanding compensation for the work done then. In similar lawsuits, other German companies such as Daimler-Benz, BMW, Audi, and even Leica are also being sued for using slave labor and collaborating with the Nazis during the Nazi era. We're going to be right back with you in 60 seconds with our guest in the studio, Ellie Gross. Stay tuned. April 1944, Mrs. Ellie Gross, our next guest, with her mother and brother, were loaded on a railroad boxcar from their native Romania for a six-day journey to Auschwitz. Ellie Gross, thank you for being with us here in the studios of Democracy Now! How did you come to be on that boxcar? What happened? Tell us from the start.
I'm Ellie Gross, born Berkovic, on February 14, 1929, Șimleul, Silvania, Romania. And on September 10, 1940, the Hungarian, by a decree of Hitler, who was the Chancellor of Europe, occupied our homeland. The Hungarian occupation brought with them the Jewish law. The Jews gradually were persecuted and eventually taken away their life, was a curfew. Jews were not allowed to travel on the train. If by necessity someone went on the train, was thrown off on the running train. On 1942, the men between age of 18 to 55, they were drafted to forced labor, including my 37 years old father. After a year, they marched all the way. To close to Moscow. Later on in 1945, after the war, I find out the trailer where they were stationed, they were poured gasoline and they were burned alive. On 1944, the spring, early in the winter, Jews had to wear a yellow star. Right after Passover, the local government and students who were not learning standards of schooling, they will learn only to hit the Jew. They stopped in the front of our home and they forced us off from our home. I was there with my 37-year-old mother and 5-year-old brother. My mother's name Irina, my brother's Adalbert. We were escorted to a ghetto, a brick factory. It's called Czechosilvania, close to Șimleul, Silvania. Then we were there about 6 weeks, and on May 27th, 1944, we were forced to, after strip search, we were forced in cattle car. That was a Saturday, and I remember that we arrived in Auschwitz on June 2nd, 1944. Early morning, was a big chaos at the ramp. Everyone was screaming. Men in striped uniform was screaming, say that you are 18. For many mothers, they took away the children, they gave to an older person. It was a chaos. Everyone was screaming, dog was barking. At the end, we were forced to stop in front of a man in uniform, an SS uniform, and with his white gloves waved to the right and left. My mother, because my brother was weak after 6.5 days in cattle car, without food and no water, she was holding him on her arm. She was waved to the left, I was waved to the right. And I waved to my mother goodbye, and I never seen her again. Mm. A photo of her is displayed in Birkenau, Auschwitz. And I have a copy of the book in which also the picture is exist. The photo is existing. Mm.
Now, you, from Auschwitz, ended up working for Volkswagen. How did that happen?
On end of August, beginning of September, no one knew the date exactly, was a large selection. Many, many of us, young, better looking ones, I mean stronger looking ones, we were selected by the same person who greeted us when we arrived, selected us on the beginning, on June 2nd, 1944. And I ended up with a large group on the disinfection place. They gave us some rags. I had a wood clog already taken away my shoe on the arrival. And many times when I started to, I mean, I was walking, well, my foot was bleeding because I never learned how to walk in that clog. And 500 of us ended up in Fallersleben. We were from that large group. The living quarter was in the factory building itself, and cross on the other side was a large triangle building, and both sides had a large entries for trucks. Above was building, but under the building was a crossroad. And when we entered to the factory, it was slanting down, and I was with six of us. We were selected to work in a narrow foyer, 2 to 3 meters wide and very long. We got each of us a small cubic and a large ventilator in front of us. Above us was a fence, and there people were walking. And the factory for the six of us who worked there gave a 0.5 liter skim milk, a work gloves, a 0.5 robe, and a mask. Something had to be in that paint, because when we had no gloves on, or the gloves was ripped, touched our skin, we get infection. I don't know what exactly happened with me. I was 15 years old, and my mouth started to bleed. The blood was pouring. We had three meisters, a Czechoslovakian with one arm, an Ukrainian who always cursed, and a short German man. The German man was sorry for me, and he bought me, risking his freedom, a small box of salt. I was rinsing my mouth, the bleeding stopped. But I got another problem. My mask probably wasn't good, or something happened. I inhaled some paint, and I was very sick. I had fever, I was coughing, and everyone complained because at night they could not sleep because of my cough.
Mm. Now, what did the factory? Now, you were, in other words, you were working in a paint department. What did the factory produce?
I don't know what they produced, because they never told to me. I was about 14 to 16 inch wide, an oval top, had a ring on some kind of screw on the top and a hole in one side, and was coming in a chain, and we had to take it off from the chain. It was pretty heavy, spray with the paint like a pistol, the paint, and we had to move that the paint should be even, and then hang it up on the chain to go into the dryer. Mm.
So you were just in one section of an assembly line that you couldn't see the rest of it?
Uh-huh. Not really.
Right. And the people who ran the factory, were they civilians or military people? Were there soldiers that guarded the factory?
We had an officer in, a German officer, a lady, mm-hmm. who was always with us. And as I mentioned, we had three meisters. at the Czechoslovakian, the Ukrainian, and the German.
You were not alone. Tell us about the people that were there with you. You mentioned some of the other women who worked with you. Who were they?
Was one girl's name was Lily, the other one Jutka, Annie, Ibi, Eva, and myself.
And they had all come from Auschwitz?
Yes, with the 500 originally group from Auschwitz.
And they were all Romanian?
Romanian or Hungarian, mm-hmm. because we belonged already to Hungary.
Right. Mm-hmm. Tell me a little about your lawsuit, what you are seeking now.
Even, I don't know, even we reach that age that we get anything, but at least the world could hear again our voice, and it's our duty if we could talk to remind the world what could happen if a lunatic is leading the world.
So it's not really about the reparations, but you are suing for financial reparations also.
If we get something, it's coming good, because everyone who is working has to be paid. And not only Volkswagen took advantage of slave labor, many other companies. It's not Volkswagen's fault that we were taken deported, but their fault that they used the slave labor.
Now, how long did you remain in the factory, and how did you finally get free of that situation?
We arrived there, as I mentioned, end of August, the beginning of September, and in April 1945, from the factory, we were evacuated to Salzwedel. And in Salzwedel, I was liberated, I don't know the date, with the others who were already from our group taken to Salzwedel, because we were a large group and only 500 of us ended up in Fallersleben.
Now, a lot of people had their attention brought to the labor that went on during the Nazi era with the movie Schindler's List, where the man who hired Jewish labor and paid them low wages was presented as a hero. Looking at this story from another perspective, you could say these are people that were exploiting slave labor and far from being heroes should be paying damages.
When he hired those people, he actually saved their life. They tried to bring families together, as I saw on the film. That is a different story.
Uh-huh.
That was a humanitarian gesture, and I think he did a great thing.
Okay. I was wanting to address the question of corporate responsibility. You talk about it to some extent, and it's interesting that the lawsuits this week follow the $1.25 billion agreement by Swiss banks to settle the claims by Holocaust survivors who weren't allowed to collect their assets after World War II. Is this the new focus, you think, from the governments and the banks to the corporations?
Many of the survivors already perished, and their wounds and their suffering. And many kill themselves, and most of them, they are on geriatric care. They need any reimbursement or money they could get to help themselves. I mean, they should be helped on their last days of their life.
Over the years after the war, whenever you would see a Volkswagen commercial or Volkswagen car, what would be some of the emotions that would go through you, or the feelings that it would rise in you?
First of all, I never knew that I worked for Volkswagen. I knew that I worked in Fallersleben. 3 years ago, someone told me that belonged to the Volkswagen. And definitely the part that I was working does not belong to a car. Definitely say that, because I know which the car, what parts they have. So they had to manufacture something else for the German government. What they did, we don't know, because they was never told me. And no one knows. And what I should say, I never would buy a Volkswagen, and I'm very surprised the American people who lost so many lives during the Second World War, they buying any produce with large amount from Germany, made in Germany.
And let's remind people that the suits that were filed this week target a lot of corporations as well as Volkswagen, the Mercedes, Daimler-Benz, BMW, Audi, Leica, Siemens, a variety of companies, not just Volkswagen and not just car manufacturers.
Practically all the major companies in Germany.
Did you have something you wanted to add, Ellie?
Practically all the factories, they were work at the time for the Nazi government, and many of them, they did not work their original products. They did some kind of producers which helped the Nazi regime to maintain.
Mm-hmm.
Or surely they were involved in the war effort, because many automobile companies in time of war change over to produce military vehicles or vehicles for warfare.
Or ammunition.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, historians believe, I think it is now, that about 7 million people were coerced into work situations in Germany under the Hitler regime in a comparable way to the way that you were. I'm imagining, since you have told your story and filed this suit and others have brought this to public attention, that you've started hearing from some of that other 7 million. Have you?
From not the 7 million exactly, many people called me because they heard the story. And actually in New York area, in a metropolitan area, there are 20 of us who survived Fahrerslagern. Mm. And they called me, and soon I'm going to get their list together and their telephone number, birthday, and from where they were deported.
Have you heard any other stories like yours in this period?
Many others, even different.
Uh-huh.
And Fahrerslagern was not the heaven. Auschwitz was the hell, and Fahrerslagern was compared to Auschwitz like the skirt of the hell.
Mm-hmm. What happened after you were liberated, after you were released? Did you try to go home to find your family?
After the liberation in Salzwedel, we were taken to the Salzwedel Armory, and my mother cousin find me on the surviving list, and I met two cousins of mine in Salzwedel, and he took us to Hillersleben. When I went even to American doctors there, and they gave me something to stop the cough, which did not. Then the Romanian government sent some kind of people there to help us to repatriate, to go back to Romania. When I arrived to my hometown, home city, Șimleu, Silvania, our home was on a hill, and I was running up to tell my parents that what I went through. Strangers lived in the house. The city put out the people from there in a few days, but I had an empty home. Mm-hmm. I was 16 years old. In a few days, somebody told me that my mother was sent to the left. I should not wait. Then the next day, somebody said that I should not wait for my father either. Was very shocky, for I should say I got numb, and I couldn't even think and talk. And I guess my mother was praying my father in the heaven for me.
Mm.
So my destiny was to go on living.
Ellie Gross, thank you so much for being with us here in Democracy Now! Ellie Gross is now a retired bookkeeper, still a working bookkeeper, who came to the United States in 1966. She is part of a lawsuit that has been filed against Volkswagen demanding compensation for slave labor during the Nazi era. Other lawsuits are targeting other German corporations like Daimler-Benz, BMW, Audi, Leica, that all are being sued for using slave labor and collaborating with the Nazis during the Nazi regime. Ellie Gross, thank you so much for being here and telling us
thank
your story.
Thank you for having me.
You're listening to Democracy Now! My name is Laura Flanders, here with Juan Gonzalez. And if you have comments about today's program, you can call the following number, 212-209-212-209. 212-209-2999, 212-209-2999. For a copy of today's show or any other Democracy Now! Program, you can call the following toll-free number, 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. And if you missed any portion of the program and want to hear it, you can on the web at www.pacifica.org, www.pacifica.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Zachary Fink and Janice K. Bryant. Errol Maitland is our technical director, Michelle Garcia, our web spinner. Julie Drizin is our executive producer from the studios of WBAI in New York. I'm Laura Flanders, sitting in for Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez for another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!